from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. For more than 20 years, neurologist Suzanne O'Sullivan has treated patients who have debilitating physical symptoms with no identifiable cause, such as paralysis, pain, and seizures. These patients, she writes, find themselves trapped in a zone between the worlds of medicine and psychiatry with neither community taking full responsibility. And she'll join us this hour to talk about her new book, Is It All in Your Head? An Exploration of Psychosomatic Disorders and Their Causes. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. When Suzanne O'Sullivan began her career as a neurologist back in 1995, she expected to treat people with conventional brain and nerve diseases like multiple sclerosis and epilepsy. But she says she could not have predicted how far she would find herself drawn into the care of those whose illnesses originated not in the body but in the mind. O'Sullivan, who's with the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London, has spent the last 20 years treating people who have illnesses with no apparent physical cause, illnesses that cause crushing physical symptoms like pain and paralysis. And she joins us this hour in studio to talk about her new book, It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness, in which she explores psychosomatic disorders, so-called, their causes and how best to treat patients who suffer from them. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess the place to begin here is just to talk about the fact that when we talk about psychosomatic, and it's a word that some express concern about because it's used often too widely and, as you point out in your book, disparagingly and as a kind of stigma. But any symptom, really, can be psychosomatic, can have its origins not in the body but in the something having to do with the body-mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to absolutely clarify what I mean by psychosomatic symptoms, I mean real physical symptoms. So they aren't sort of symptoms that are imaginary in any way. They cause people significant distress and disability, but they can't be fully explained by medical examination or physical examination. And basically, they pretty much could be any symptom that you can imagine. And every sort of specialist doctor sees this represented in their practice in sort of 20 to 30% of their patients. So to a cardiologist, it could be chest pain or palpitations that can't be explained by heart disease. To a neurologist, it's headache, dizziness, paralysis, seizures. The symptoms really don't define the disorder. It's the degree of disability that's out of proportion to any disease that can be found.
And the numbers are staggering. I mean, as you write in your book, general practitioners see this about one of three cases, and neurologists with dizziness, as you say, and things of that sort, one in five. Those numbers are huge, but no single cause, no single answer, really. I mean, in fact, you say it's like looking for a cure for unhappiness.
Exactly. And I think perhaps that's been a mistake that has been made in the past, is often when people got physical symptoms that were believed to be for psychological or behavioral reasons, it was assumed that it was due to something like a major psychological trauma. Whereas actually, I think that these are very diverse symptoms that have very diverse causes. And therefore, it's very naive of us to think that everything is due to a particular sort of stress or a particular way of thinking about your body. I think these are a huge range of problems, and there will be a very large range of answers to it.
And the most common are fatigue and pain, and the most common afflicted are women. Disproportionately, yes.
Yes, it's true. I mean, fatigue and pain are particularly difficult symptoms to deal with psychosomatically because they're not measurable. So as a neurologist, I deal with people who have paralysis and loss of consciousness. And these are very objectively measurable things, whereas fatigue and pain are things you can only describe to somebody, and therefore they're particularly problematic to diagnose. And you are correct that many of these disorders are more common in women. That was something that, as a woman, I personally resisted for a while because I couldn't help observing during the training period when I was being trained largely by men that men are more inclined to make a diagnosis of a psychosomatic disorder in women than they are in men, so it can be disproportionately represented for that reason.
Even that word hysteria goes back to a kind of gender of
identity. Well, I mean, it refers to the womb, and, you know, hysteria comes from a a disorder in which they believe that the womb travelled around the body causing different symptoms. So if you had a sore throat, the womb had travelled to your throat and caused symptoms in that way. And it's interesting as well that where hysteria really had its heyday in the end of the 19th, beginning of 20th century with Freud and Charcot, the French neurologist, they described many cases and all the cases they described were women. But what's particularly interesting is that all of the patients were not women, just the ones they described in the literature. And they both quite clearly said that this is a disorder of men and women. For some reason, history has been more comfortable speaking about this as a purely female disease.
But we are talking about psychosomatic illnesses being, what, about 70%, you say in your book?
It differs slightly for different sort of forms of this disorder. But the overall percentages are approximately 70% women and 30% men. I think men and women suffer differently. And I think that women are more likely to be in the circumstances that can create these sorts of disorders. So,
you mean like sexual trauma and that sort of thing?
Well, certainly things like sexual trauma can, for example, seizures caused hysterical seizures. 30% of people have suffered sexual abuse. However, that means that 70% have not. So other causes may be less obvious, such as being in a very trapped situation, which is a situation that women are more likely to get into than men. So certainly is more common in women, but I think that men also have illnesses that are more common in them, so we just suffer differently.
We're talking with Suzanne O'Sullivan, neurologist and author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. She'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6 p.m., and you'll have an opportunity to speak with her in this hour. And when you talk about, when you even use a word like imaginary, I mean, This is part of the problem with the stigma, isn't it? Because if you can't find sources and causes for these that are organic, let's say, immediately people say, well, it's imaginary, it's in your head, therefore it shouldn't have the weight or the importance, and it's stigmatized.
Absolutely. I mean, that's such an important point. I mean, the pain of a psychosomatic disorder is every bit as painful as the pain of any sort of disease. So the symptoms are just as real and just as disabling. What I usually say to my patients is, imagine when you're very frightened and your heart, doubles in speed and you get palpitations. You're not imagining that increase in your heart rate. There's nothing imaginary about the symptoms, but they're not happening because of a heart disease. And it's similar with the sort of pain, tiredness, seizures and so forth that you get with psychosomatic disorders. The symptoms are real. They're just not due to a disease. But unfortunately, the minute tests are normal, there is an immediate attitude of dismissal that, if you have seizures because you have epilepsy, it's considered to be more serious than if you have seizures for psychosomatic reasons. Whereas the truth is that those things are equally serious and should be treated with the same amount of respect.
And we're talking about an estimated spending of some $265 million here in the United States, which is, as Dr. O'Sullivan points out in her book, twice of what's spent on diabetes. Again, a pretty staggering figure to wrestle with. I was also find myself kind of wrestling with, talking about Freud again for a moment.
Yeah.
You mentioned Charcot, but I was thinking about Breuer. A lot of that early work suggested that if you get to the cause, the root cause of what the body-mind is processing here and creating in the way of symptoms, you can pretty much, get rid of the symptom. And That's just not the case, is it?
Well, I wish it were that simple. And certainly sort of in Studies in Hysteria, which Freud wrote with Breuer, the suggestion was that if you could trace an individual symptom back to the point at which it started and you could identify the trigger, that symptom would magically melt away. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that, nor do we really consider the symptoms to be symbolic in the way that Freud considered them to be. So, for example, in Studies in Hysteria, there's a case where a woman developed a pain in her leg and it transpired that pain originated in exactly the point where her father used to rest his foot when he was in his deathbed. And, this realization was supposed to make the pain go away. We don't really see the symptoms in that way any longer. And unfortunately, the solutions aren't quite that straightforward either. I think it's much more common now that the symptoms actually are drawn from our life experience and our own personal experience and things that are happening to our bodies. So, for example, I've often seen people who've developed things like paralysis after an injury. So they have a straightforward injury, which is an organic problem. But then what leads to the paralysis is how they respond to the injury and how they think about their body in response to the injury, rather than it being something sort of symbolic of a trauma in their life.
I want to talk about some of the individual cases that you present in your book. But before we do that, let's talk about what to do in a general sense. But this is so tailored to the individual specifically, what you're talking about here, that it suggests, there are things that work. Talk therapy has, had some successes. Placebos have had some successes. But when you talk about really what to do, there's no single solution, and it has to be tailored to the individual, no?
Absolutely. I mean, you really just have to listen to the person's story and try and get a feel for how this problem has developed. So if I compare sort of a couple of people, so I would see a percentage of people who have seizures who have suffered very serious abuse in childhood. And people who have that sort of background leading to their disorder will obviously need psychological and psychiatric help that might need to be extensive. On the other hand, I may see people who've suffered something like a back injury and they've had great difficulty recovering from that back injury, and concern about how slowly they're recovering has led to disability. Someone like that doesn't necessarily need extensive psychoanalytic intervention. Someone like that who cannot walk probably needs a really great physiotherapist who's psychologically minded, who can give them the confidence to walk again and help them deal with the fear and avoidance that's stopping them from walking. So sometimes people need psychiatric intervention, but other times people really need rehabilitation more than anything.
In many cases, they often need a collaboration of the two. And as you suggest, it's not necessarily done in the way it needs to be done to meet the needs of this population, in the same way that Big Pharma is not necessarily stepping up to offer the kind of solutions that might be at hand with respect to body mind. But since you mentioned seizures, let's talk about one of your cases, Camelia, who suffered seizures that were definitely related to the death of a child.
Yeah. I mean, Camilla is really a very, very intelligent, extremely insightful woman who had a very responsible career, very successful life, and she developed seizures apparently out of the blue and was unable to identify a trigger. She believed in the first instance she had epilepsy, but ultimately we are able to diagnose these sort of seizures by measuring people's brainwaves during the attacks, and very reliably we're able to say that she had what we used to call hysterical seizures and we now call dissociative seizures. And it was very, very difficult for Camilla to recognize the reason this had happened to her. And it really, her story unfolded very slowly, and I think that's how it has to happen sometimes. I had known her for quite a long time before she was able to make a link to the fact that she had collapsed once in the distant past before the seizures began. And that one time she had collapsed was actually following the tragic loss of her child in an accident. And there was no doubt that this sort of tragic loss was linked to the seizures, which she developed several years later.
Sometimes this is like a big puzzle, really, putting it together. You also write about a woman named Ivana who went blind after an accident with a cleaning product, for example. Mm. And sometimes these things, the whole trajectory of them have to be traced, and you have to go into detail to really find out. But in some cases, it's pretty one of the cases you mentioned, for example, it's a little more obscure. There's a woman named Pauline. I don't know if you're using the real names or not, but I suspected not. And this had to do with something that happened next door to her.
Yeah. I mean, Pauline had when I met Pauline in her 30s, but she'd had a series of medical illness dating from her mid-teen years until her 30s. And all of those medical illnesses, and they were things as dramatic as being unable to pass urine, so she had to self-catheterize, she was in a wheelchair for a period, she had seizures, she had pain, she had abdominal pain. And it was very difficult for her to get away from the over-medicalization of her diagnosis. And in this sort of unraveling of it, you know, when she was quite a young child, I think about 11 years old, there had been an incident within the family in which there had been accusations of sexual abuse, although nothing had actually happened to Pauline. And that had kind of broken the family apart. And in a strange way, her illness had kept her father close to her and had changed the dynamics in the family. And I think that the more her illnesses were medicalized, the more she responded to them in that way. So it was a very slowly unraveling story. Unfortunately, when somebody's illness has lasted as long as that, it's very difficult to make them better, even when you recognize what the cause was in the start. And that's why I'm really trying to emphasize the idea that we consider these things earlier.
Tell me a little bit more about why you think the numbers are so much higher as far as women are concerned with these kind of psychosomatic afflictions, particularly in light of the fact that you can make the case that men are under terrible stress and, you know, have onerous things on their backs and shoulders and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to tell you that I know the answer for certain. I don't. But I think that to a certain degree, it is that women are very much in a particular situation that promotes these, where situations in which they're trapped, situations in which they can't get out of. Women are more likely to have suffered physical or sexual abuse in childhood. But there's also a degree to which what we consider acceptable, what we consider acceptable in the behavior of men and women. So it is in some way more socially acceptable for women to complain in a certain way about their headaches or their aches and their pains. It's less acceptable for a man to do that. I think that men and women, our lives are difficult and we show it in different ways. Men have a higher level of alcoholism. Men are more likely to get into kind of aggressive outbursts and so forth. And obviously, I'm sure people are aware that there's a much higher rate of suicide amongst young men. So I think that men and women are expressing their distress differently. And there's something influencing in the ways in which it's socially acceptable to express our distress.
Well, you write a lot about the mind-body connection, and stress is a good example of that. I mean, you know, you even said when you went on a book tour, you lost your voice initially. You thought maybe there was a connection.
I have quite a hoarse voice today, and I'm absolutely not ruling out the possibility that, you know, faced with the anxiety of using my voice for something very important for the next couple of weeks, that is affecting me. Because, you know, it would be a classical example. For the last couple of weeks, I live in London. There's been a flu going around London. I've been very concerned that I would get sick and it would interrupt this journey. And I've been focused on my health. And then I get a flu and then I lose my voice. So it's possible I have the flu and it's possible that I'm anxious about what's ahead of me.
But you can also have symptoms without, somebody can be so concerned and anxious about getting the flu that suddenly the symptoms crop up without any flu being.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a really classical way for psychosomatic disorders to develop is that we look out. I had another example in myself in which I broke a bone in my foot and I had to wear a non-weight bearing cast for a couple of weeks. My foot became very wasted. And when the cast came off and I had to walk in it again, I felt like this wasn't normal, that my foot was more wasted than it should have been. I was afraid to put my weight on my foot. And every time I did, I feared that I could visualize the bones separating. And that sort of, for a very brief period of time, that caused me difficulty walking. And as soon as I sort of got the reassurance from my doctor that everything was okay, I made a miraculous recovery again. But the point is, you know, that that's not a psychosomatic disorder. We all get somatic symptoms, so bodily symptoms, because we're worried about our health from time to time. But it's how you deal with it that decides whether you're someone who occasionally gets somatic symptoms or you're someone who gets somatic symptoms and then gets a somatic disorder.
Well, the mind-body connection, you use some rather quotidian or daily kind of examples of when you feel emotional about something and tears come to your eyes, or when you blush, or when you get sweat on your brow because you're feeling stress of some sort. These are all pretty exemplary, and it seems to me fairly incontrovertible. I'm just wondering, though, about, again, what can be done and what sort of things, if you would address that for us, particularly in terms of education. I mean, how much really in medical training is devoted to these kinds of issues with psychosomatic illness?
I mean, absolutely, that is where I think it is most important to change. So my point really when I became a consultant was I was looking after people with seizures, and a huge proportion of them had these hysterical dissociative seizures. And although within my training it was recognized that this is a common thing encountered by neurologists, because we're so highly specialized now, if somebody doesn't have a neurological disease, it's like it's no longer your responsibility. So that's how we're trained now. We're compartmentalized. And in my medical school training, I would say that psychosomatic disorders were never mentioned. And it was very much the case that when you were trawling hospital wards trying to learn about medical diseases, that somebody who had a medical problem but no clinical signs or identifiable disease didn't interest you, they had nothing to teach you. The truth is that person is going to be one third of your workload, whatever specialty you do. So I think this needs to be given the same attention and the same respect as everything else, rather than being what it is at the moment, which is a diagnosis of exclusion. So something you only consider and talk about when you've ruled out everything else.
Do you have a take on some of these diseases which had a good deal of controversy, autoimmune diseases, particularly the Epstein-Barr syndrome?
I think that in the case of things like Epstein-Barr and also autoimmune disorders, I think people aren't aware how grey some of the test results are for these things. So most of us have been exposed to things like Epstein-Barr virus at some point in our lives. So if we do a blood test looking for it, we might reveal that exposure. But all of the doctors who do those blood tests don't know how to interpret them. And that can lead to people being overdiagnosed with things. Similarly, autoantibodies, they're very open to interpretation. So these disorders are very serious when one has them, but they're also massively overdiagnosed because the blood test results are not a straightforward positive or negative, and they're open to interpretation.
Well, as long as we're talking about tests, I alluded before to MRIs. There are MRIs that show evidence even when there's no organic cause.
I mean, I would think very long and hard before I agreed to have an MRI scan of my brain, because quite a large proportion of people, MRI scans are so sensitive now, and we're as different on the inside as we are on the outside. I mean, we have the same basic elements, but we don't look the same. And when we scan our brains, we find these little differences also. So, for example, we find cysts and little white spots that we don't know how to fully explain. And the minute you find those as a doctor, you're obligated to pursue them. Or if you have a brain scan because you're anxious about something and then you discover you have this non-specific finding, it isn't likely to help your anxiety any. So over-investigation can be really problematic and can lead to further investigations and misdiagnosis.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. She's a neurologist. She's also author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. And I imagine some of you listening may have some of your own stories to add to the discussion here. But we would like to hear from you, and we would like to enjoin you to be part of our conversation here. If you have something you'd like to say, there are big questions about education for medical people and health providers, big questions related to the costs and the stigma that obviously we've touched upon. And you may want to lend your voice to the discussion. We certainly welcome hearing from you. Our toll-free number is available, and let me give you that number. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number. Emotions affecting symptoms, a lot of it, without necessarily biological origins. Toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways you can become part of this conversation. And I should mention that Dr. O'Sullivan will be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6 o'clock p.m. But in the meantime, we certainly would like to hear from you, so please feel free to join us. Any symptom, again, on really any part of the anatomy can be, and indeed all too often is, psychosomatic. So why the stigma, and why not do something about it, particularly in terms of medical education and really education of the citizens? We'll hear from you when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with neurologist Suzanne O'Sullivan on psychosomatic illnesses and how the mind affects the body. Her book is called Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. And for more than 20 years, she treated patients who had debilitating physical symptoms, pain, seizures, with no identifiable causes. And these patients, she notes, find themselves trapped in a zone between the worlds of medicine and psychiatry, with neither community taking full responsibility. She's talking with us about this, and you can join the conversation. Our toll-free number, again, let me remind you, is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's Susan, who writes, Dr. O'Sullivan, have you considered that Western medicine has its limits and that acupuncture or another form of medicine may explain this psychosomatic symptom and also provide a cure for the condition that is causing the symptoms?
I certainly have no objection to alternative cures such as acupuncture, for example. I think that I don't think it's a good idea if alternative cures get in the way of appropriate investigation with conventional medicine in the first instance. But where other things aren't working, then I think that these are really good complementary therapies, assuming that you've also seen your doctor.
Here's David, who writes, while there are certainly many psychosomatic illnesses, it is also falsely presumptive of doctors to believe that the current body of medical knowledge is adequate to explain all physical symptoms. My father was a doctor for over 50 years, and during his career, he had to unlearn almost everything he was taught in medical school because modern research disproved much of what was taught in medical schools. It is a mistake for doctors to assume that everything they can't explain is psychosomatic. Scientific research continues to explain things that were previously unknown.
I think it's a really important point to make the distinction between people who have diseases that we don't yet have a full explanation for and people who have psychosomatic disorders. So, for example, in neurology, there's a really big distinction, but we frequently see people who have seizures and paralysis, etc., who clearly have a disease that we cannot diagnose. But psychosomatic disorders are quite distinct. They don't fit with anatomy. There is a very big disparity between objective clinical signs and the subjective experience of the patient. And they can be influenced by psychological interventions and reassurance. So certainly there are lots of diseases and, you know, neurology is famous for not curing people. So, you know, we're very good. Neurologists are very good at diagnosing people and pretty terrible at actually curing them. And we accept how much we don't know. But I think it would be a mistake to say that psychosomatic disorder sufferers have a disease we haven't discovered yet. In 1965, a prominent psychiatrist published an article on this saying that he expected if you followed these patients up in the long term that at least 25% would ultimately have neurological diseases. In fact, many of these patients have been followed up in the long term since then, and the misdiagnosis rate is about 4%, which is a similar misdiagnosis rate for any sort of disorder.
There's also... excuse me, that was not a psychosomatic sneeze. there's also a... maybe pushing the limit or the envelope when it comes to the mind-body connection. I mean, for example, there are people who believe that your attitude, and certainly, you know, your attitude and your outlook can be an enormous influence on your health and your symptoms, but that attitude can cure just about anything, including cancer. And I think the evidence is pretty distinctly opposed to that.
Yeah, I mean, there really is no evidence to suggest that, you know, that you can cure serious diseases with a sort of positive outlook. I mean, I don't think it's utterly ridiculous to suggest. I mean, we know that stress hormones can affect our immune system. So there's absolutely, it's not ridiculous to suggest that when we're under a degree of stress, that we're more vulnerable to illness. But I would hate for anybody who suffers with a serious disease to feel that they were in some way responsible for having brought it on themselves or that they had the power to cure it themselves.
Or that they got rid of guilt or those kinds of things that suddenly the disease or the symptoms would be ameliorated. Let me read you a tweet from David who says, are psychosomatic problems more prevalent in older generations? Do certain diseases like diabetes bring on more disorders?
No, I mean, I think diabetes is a multi-system disease which causes a lot of different medical complaints, and I would separate it entirely for anything psychosomatic. Psychosomatic disorders have different peaks at different ages. They very often come on in younger people, teen years and 20s, but there is a second peak later in life when it becomes quite prevalent again. So really, it's a disorder that can affect anyone at any age.
And I am getting a question about placebo effect. It can actually heal symptoms.
Absolutely.
The evidence is there. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a large part of what your doctor does when you go and see them with a sore throat or non-specific symptoms is they reassure you and tell you that you'll be better in 5 to 10 days. And that is a sort of placebo effect at work. So certainly if the problem has a psychological or behavioral basis, then a placebo can be curative.
Let me go to our calls, and let's begin with Megan. Megan, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was curious if your guest has seen this phenomenon in children at all.
Well, I'm not a specialist in pediatrics. However, children do get psychosomatic problems. So the really classical ones are children who get pains in their stomach when they're anxious about school or they don't want to go to school or they're being bullied and so forth. So certainly this is something that can happen to children also.
We thank you, Megan, for the call. Let me go to more of your calls here, and we go to Deborah next. Deborah, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, yes. I'm very intrigued by this conversation and thank the doctor for looking forward to reading her book. I find myself in this curious gray area with having been told by doctors my multi-system illnesses for years that there was nothing wrong with me and it was psychological. Then later, a year and a half or so ago, to be diagnosed with Lyme disease, which is a controversial subject. I'd love to hear the doctor's thoughts on this. My most recent symptom, and this puts me square in some of the things you've already discussed, is weakness in my arms and legs. That's a brand new symptom for which I'm now awaiting the results of MRIs that were done over the weekend. Can this be psychosomatic in my case with some of those indicators in there? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And then also anything your thoughts on Lyme disease in particular.
I mean, obviously, I couldn't possibly kind of comment on an individual person's symptoms. I mean, any symptom can be psychosomatic. And if you have multiple different kind of symptoms that flit around the body from place to place, and every time you have a test, the test is normal, that would be a really classical sort of story for someone with a psychosomatic illness. But I wouldn't wish to comment on any individual's diagnosis. It was interesting what you said at the very start, which was that you were told there was nothing wrong, that it was psychological. And that's something that that's the exact mindset I'm trying to change. You know, the physical symptoms that someone gets for a psychosomatic disorder is not equivalent to nothing, but that is the language we tend to use in conjunction with it. So if you're not well, there's something wrong, whether it's a disease or whether it's psychosomatic. And with regards to Lyme disease, unfortunately, I think Lyme disease is overdiagnosed. I think that Lyme disease in those who have acute Lyme disease is very serious and a very dangerous disorder to suffer with. However, I think that a large proportion of people have been overdiagnosed with Lyme disease.
It's a difficult diagnosis because if you don't see that target, and many people don't see it, it's not visible, they think they have Lyme disease.
I think that basically the blood tests for Lyme disease, if they're not in the hands of an absolute expert, are extremely open to interpretation. And I fear that there's a very large proportion of people throughout the world who carry a diagnosis of Lyme disease who don't actually have Lyme disease.
I've got a tweet from Chris who wants to know if you have any thoughts on fibromyalgia being a psychosomatic problem.
Yes, I do think fibromyalgia is a psychosomatic problem. It's a very significant, very disabling problem. And I certainly think that it would fall within the psychosomatic classification.
But it's so difficult sometimes. I mean, people can get anxiety about, say, giving a talk and suddenly they have a stomach ache. I mean,
yeah.
It's a common occurrence, something along those lines. And as a result, it may be the anxiety over the talk, the thing that public speaking being the greatest fear among Americans, apparently, or maybe even throughout the Western world, or getting a stomach ache or a headache or any of those kinds of things. It might be real, though. I mean, you know, in so many instances, it's difficult to determine, maybe impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it is extremely difficult. You know, and people shouldn't be afraid. You know, if you get a symptom in the context of stress, it's perfectly okay to go to your doctor and discuss it with them. And if you feel that your doctor has listened to you properly and examined you properly, then take the reassurance that they offer. It's very difficult to tell the difference between these symptoms yourself. But unfortunately, in the context of, you know, public speaking, etc., is exactly how these things begin. It's, you know, you these symptoms can present in that context, but if you don't put it together with the situation that you're in, it can be misinterpreted and over-medicalized.
Again, we're talking to Suzanne O'Sullivan, author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. And David joins us. David, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. And thanks so much, Doctor, for writing this book and raising awareness about the mind and the body connection. I'm a psychotherapist and have worked with people, young girls in particular. One in particular I'm thinking about who had a mother with a very strange autoimmune disorder that nobody really understands. They didn't tell her about it. And my patient began to get very, very ill, and the symptoms that she was having mimicked the symptoms that her mother was having. And it was actually through psychoanalytic therapy that we realized together that this was all about her lifelong fear that her mother was going to die. So I just kind of want to put a plug in there about contemporary psychoanalytic thinking about the body and the mind, because it's not the way it was in Freud's day.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly have heard very similar stories to that, and I think you're absolutely correct. And very often people's symptoms are drawn from some experience in their life. So it wouldn't be unusual for me to see people with seizures whose sister had epilepsy, for example. So this sort of framing of your distress based on how you see others' distress expressed is quite common. And I also feel that, you know, earlier perhaps I was dismissive of going down more the psychoanalytic route. I wouldn't wish to say that. I just think that in the Freudian days, everybody was thought to need psychoanalysis. Now I think that basically it's very beneficial for some people, and those people can really improve dramatically, but it isn't necessary for everybody.
I reread a definition of psychoanalysis by Vladimir Nabokov, a famous novelist, author of Lolita and many other works, that I never seem to recall, but it came back to mind. A lot of myths that have to do with the privates, which is really kind of funny and maybe in some ways on the mark. Here's Heather, who writes, can you talk about the ways that depression and other conditions affect real medical ones? My mother has Parkinson's disease, but it seems to me that her depression makes her symptoms worse and maybe creating new ones. What type of doctor do you recommend people see to untangle these situations?
Well, I think it's really important that we remember, I mean, that the brain and the mind are all intermingled, basically. So everyone, or almost everyone who suffers with a brain disease will develop problems like depression or anxiety. So it wouldn't be unusual at all for someone with Parkinson's disease to also get anxiety-related problems or depression-related problems. And that's why we need more multidisciplinary teams. So we need to treat someone with Parkinson's disease not just for the movement problems they have, but also for the behavioral or emotional problems. It's really about improving liaison psychiatry services. So those psychiatrists who specialize in caring for people who have medical problems primarily.
But you know, recently someone I was close to died of glioblastoma, brain cancer, and the depression that came on as a result of really just thinking about mortality and thinking about the fact that, you know, this was an end game and so forth, and all the loved ones we're going to be without and so forth, brought on symptoms.
Yeah. And I think that it really improves people's quality of life if you can address the psychological issues that come with disease. And it would be lovely to see those services better integrated.
Let's integrate some more of our callers here. And we go next to Pat. Pat, you're on.
Hi. Hello?
Yes. Hi. You're on the air.
Yes. I am a doctor. And in internal medicine, I never ascribe psychosomatic disorder to any patient until, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt until I've done my thorough investigation and exam, et cetera. But about 7 or 8 years ago, I had myself a very advanced cancer. And up to now, I still can't talk about it. I can't talk about it, and I'm happiest when I don't think about it. I also feel that
you're talking about it now, Pat.
I know. I know, but I can't. But anyway, up to, you know, I feel also there's some, I feel woolly-headed. Even though I can answer Jeopardy questions, I'm great at doing crossword puzzles, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there is something I feel, and I'm not sure. I think there's a certain, maybe this is just anxiety. And so I think it there is definitely, I think, a component of psychosomatic overlay for this. Even myself, not wanting to ascribe it to patients, I do feel that I myself have some amount of this in my own illness.
So you've gone from being a doubter to a believer?
Well, in my own case, that's what I can ascribe because I can do everything else.
Yeah. Dr. O'Sullivan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very sorry to hear about what a difficult time you've had, but certainly sort of problems like difficulty concentrating and poor memory are really, really common manifestations of psychological distress. And that distress might be for a very good reason, but that doesn't change the fact that these symptoms occur. You know, if your brain is full of anxiety and difficulty expressing the anxiety about your health, it wouldn't necessarily be surprising that there's not room in there for your thoughts to form coherently. I'd also like to make a point about the first thing that you said, which is giving the patient the benefit of the doubt and only considering psychosomatic as a kind of end of diagnosis, last resort. I mean, that's sort of the problem, really, is that if we're considering it as giving somebody the benefit of the doubt, then we're kind of stigmatizing them. We're saying they've something wrong with them that they have some control over. And by waiting 6 months to give a person a diagnosis, we're depriving them of the help that they could be getting at an earlier stage. So I'd like to see this diagnosis being considered as equal. If I have chest pain, is it my heart or am I anxious? I'd like my cardiologist to consider those possibilities equally at the start so that I can get treatment from both at the start.
And Pat, let me thank you for the call and read a comment from a listener named Barbara who writes, I'm a marriage and family therapist who did a year of postgraduate work in the office of a rheumatologist training in a specialty called medical family therapy. I work with patients who had fibromyalgia, mostly female. I would estimate that 80% of them had childhood trauma, such as physical or sexual abuse. And your work is consistent with my findings. I look forward to this becoming a more mainstream way of looking at patients with complex disorders. We were talking before about chronic fatigue. Can you, another case involving a woman in your book, Rachel, the dancer.
Yes. I mean, Rachel was an overachiever and she was going to be a dancer professionally when she got struck down with a mystery illness. And that mystery illness led to her being very severely fatigued, and that led to her getting a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, it's extremely controversial to discuss chronic fatigue syndrome in the context of psychosomatic illness. My point of including it in the book is very much to say that things that cannot be measured and things that cannot be seen and things that can only be described to us by others are still real, and that if a person feels sufficiently fatigued that they're not able to carry on with their life, that's something we should take very seriously. And that's the sort of thing that we should give the same amount of attention to and research to and resources to as we would to a disease. But unfortunately, sort of when we can't actually measure a disease, we have great difficulty respecting the way that people suffer. And I think that has affected the way that illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome are viewed.
Well, what do you say to, you know, the person who says, well, that's not a real disease, you know, it's in your head. Therefore, it doesn't have the weight in my mind that it would have if you had a diagnosis based on evidence.
Well, unfortunately, that is the attitude, is that, you know, if people find out that their next door neighbor who's in a wheelchair is in a wheelchair because they have multiple sclerosis, they see them one way. If they find they're in a wheelchair for psychological reasons, they will immediately downgrade that person's disability in their head. That absolutely has to change, particularly because if a person who has a severe physical symptoms for psychological reasons is given the correct attention and resources and research and help, they can get better. It makes it even more important that we address this issue rather than continue to dismiss it.
There are people, however, who create symptoms for fraudulent reasons and to get disability.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that happens, and it's important to make the distinction that psychosomatic disorder is a completely unconscious thing. So in the same way that if my hands shake when I'm nervous, I have no control over that, it's a completely unconsciously generated, then that is how psychosomatic disorders are. Unfortunately, I find that people with significant disability for psychological reasons tend to be judged as malingerers. Malingering is just an illegal activity. It's where somebody fakes illness for financial gain.
It's hard to determine. I remember a case where this husband and wife were caught on video camera exchanging wheelchair, you know, and they were living high off the hog. For the kind of income that they possessed before they had these disabilities that they completely invented and surely fabricated.
Yeah. obviously it can be difficult in the first instance to distinguish these different disorders. I do find that there's quite a big difference in behaviour between people who are malingering and those who have psychosomatic problems. So people who have psychosomatic problems, they are in a really intense kind of pursuit of an explanation. So they're presenting for investigations, and when their MRI scan is normal, they're genuinely perplexed by it and they want another MRI scan, a better one, because they're in search for a disease that they absolutely believe to be there. Whereas I find that people who are malingering and they're aware that they don't have a disease are much more reluctant to present for investigations. And I do think malingering is in the minority here.
More of your calls. Linda, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've been a huge athlete, tennis and running. And at 44, one night folding laundry, I had a groin spasm. And I'm now 61. I've lived with this every day of my life. I went into therapy. I resolved some early childhood trauma. I'm a psychotherapist myself. And the diagnosis is neuropathic pain, but nothing on an MRI has ever shown any root cause of it. My point is when I flare, which is often, I berate myself. I believe that perhaps there's, you know, what is a secondary gain? Why am I continuing to suffer this way? And yet, you know, I'm functioning as well as I can. I'm doing the best I can. I'm fully working again. But I believe that there's some psychosomatic, but I can't get to any root to it.
Yeah.
And yet I still suffer, and I know I will until I take my last breath. And I'm wondering, is my goal just to reach acceptance? This is something I have, even though, you know, doctors and people who respected me so much for my ability to play such top-notch tennis and run now have looked at me like why didn't I just get over it? You know, why didn't the so-called injury just heal? And I question that myself so much. And I'm wondering.
Now, you've just said, though, I'm sorry, I couldn't help but hear you say, Linda, that you thought this would be with you for the rest of your life, as if you're consigning this fate to yourself. My ears perked up when you said that, but let me go to Dr. O'Sullivan and get her response.
Yeah, again, let me just commiserate. I mean, pain is an awful thing because, you know, other people can't see it, and it's very hard there for others to appreciate how it feels for you, which makes it a particularly difficult problem, I think. I mean, my immediate feeling is that you're being way too hard on yourself. I mean, I think this was one of the problems with the Freudian view of how these disorders developed, is that we always felt that we needed to pinpoint them on a particular thing. And sometimes that just is not very easy at all. Very often there isn't a particular thing on which you can hang a particular diagnosis. And I think for many years, doctors and patients were kind of locked in an argument where doctors were going, you know, there must be something and you must think of it. And if you do, then you will feel better. It just isn't like that. And
you read some of these classic cases like Anna O, you know, yeah. The Freudian case, probably one of the most classic ones. And it seems as if sometimes Freud is just following all this kind of intuition and subjective thinking that doesn't necessarily really have much basis to it.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And a lot of the cases which apparently, such as Anna O, who apparently got better at the end of their chapters and studies in hysteria, later relapsed, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't think there is any magic answer. And I think if you get to a point where you're berating yourself and looking for explanations, then you're being too hard on yourself. And sometimes we just have to accept we don't have explanations for everything.
Linda, let me wish you good luck and thank you for the call. Here's Patrick, who writes, currently the conversation has covered psychosomatic as a binary, meaning that something is or is not psychosomatic. What do you think about changing the conversation to one where the mind and body operate in a mutual causal feedback loop where the mind impacts every physical manifestation?
Well, I mean, that's 100% correct. I mean, you don't have to have no disease in order to suffer in a kind of psychosomatic way. You know, it may be that you suffer with asthma, but your symptoms are out of proportion to the amount of disease that can be found. So the mind and body, in the absence or presence of a disease, are very closely interlinked and affect your physical well-being.
Levi, you're our next caller. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, is it Levi? Oh, I can hear you, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Dr. Sullivan had heard of a case like mine. When I was young, I didn't have allergies and asthma, but around 8 years old, you know, we lived with pets, had no problems, and my parents had a really, really traumatic divorce. And within a year, I developed allergies and asthma so bad that I had to actually go to the hospital every year for middle school and the first couple of years of high school.
Dr. Sullivan. Yeah.
Again, I'm not a specialist in respiratory medicine, but asthma is something that is both A, overdiagnosed sometimes, and B, is something that most people with asthma will say that they get worse at times of anxiety. So I would think that, you know, it would be reasonable to suggest that there's an interplay there, although obviously in the case of something like asthma or allergies, you would certainly need your doctor's opinion on that.
And let me thank you for the call. Quick question from Laverne. Are there any statistics about the frequency of illnesses, these illnesses based on economic status, meaning those who can afford to seek care for pain versus those who cannot take time away from work or can't afford to get help for pain?
Well, actually, there was a very interesting World Health Organization study that looked at the rates of medically unexplained symptoms, as they're called, in lots of different countries. And there are countries as diverse as Chile, India, Germany, the USA, Brazil. And actually, the rates of these disorders are actually comparable, irrespective of what the economy of the country is or what sort of health service they have.
Dr. Sullivan, good to have you. Thank you. Thank you for your work. And the book, again, is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. You can meet Susanna Sullivan this evening. She'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 p.m. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated in the evening. Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irina Gucci, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Annie Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font and Jeremy Siegel. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of the program this morning. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.